Welcome. I'm Rick Barden, the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here at CSIS with Karen Von Hippel, who is on her way back from Yemen right now, where she has been an election observer. And on behalf of John Hamry, our president, and Kurt Campbell, who runs the International Security Program, we're happy to have you here for what we think will be a really good discussion. A year ago, we completed a report on progress in Afghanistan that was called In the Balance. And I know many of you have seen this. It's also available online. I highly recommend a hard copy as opposed to the online version just because it has lots of color and graphics that don't do so well if you're printing. And basically, it was a review of progress, but also we tried to introduce a thorough kind of hybrid methodology for how you might look at these places, because we knew that there were a number of very difficult questions that we wanted to answer, not just in the case of Afghanistan, but in looking at these situations more globally. How do you measure progress in complex conflict zones, which are often the targets of significant political posturing? How do you develop a trusted model when most of the data is unreliable and the anecdotes are rumor-filled? We chose to do this with a balanced and comprehensive approach that uses polls and focus groups, official reports, newspaper accounts, our own personal interviews, and a series of structured conversations with Afghans all over the country. The result was a baseline measurement and a model that we are now revisiting to determine what is going on in Afghanistan. And I think as a result of this early report, we probably have the most comprehensive, most widely accepted baseline that we can now compare what's happening this year. Thanks to USAID, that process is now in play, and we expect to repeat our complete findings at the end of this year or in about 3 months. Our team leader, Seema Patel, has done a superb job of meeting several challenges. The first one is that she's reviewed and improved our model. There are obviously, since this was sort of the Model T, we knew there was a lot that we could do to improve it, and she's really taken a thorough look at that without losing, I think, any of its richness. She spent a tremendous amount of time, really over the last couple months, in Afghanistan, training, preparing, and developing our interviewers. She also conducted her own interviews, and again, a lot of this data is on the sheet that you were handed. She's now here today trying to pull together some of her first impressions. She's got this incredible richness of data and information that's come in. And we've asked her to do it rather quickly because we know the timeliness of this issue and the interest in the community. But we also recognize that she's just back in processing all that she has heard and seen. I would like, thanks to the assistance of Global Relief Technologies, of which on whose board I serve, they've made a generous contribution of handheld communications devices so that our interviewers were able to send the information in a timely fashion back to their kind of data crunching facility in New Hampshire. And so we have some early comparisons from the field, which are obviously you're seeing in the documents that we passed out. But today we basically have a dialogue with Seema. She's going to share many of her impressions, and then we really look forward to the conversation with all of you. We're grateful for Seema's superb and courageous work in the field. It's not an easy place to work. For Steve Ross, her teammates anchoring the team here. And we're thankful for USAID's support and the ongoing generosity of the Carnegie Corporation of New York, which makes a lot of our work possible. So, Seema, it's all yours, and we look forward to the discussion period.
Sure. I'd like to thank you all for coming out here. We originally planned this event as a small brown bag that we were going to hold in one of the smaller conference rooms upstairs, but the overwhelming response from you guys made us rethink that and shift over to a larger room so that we can accommodate everybody. Like Rick said, I just returned from a 6-week trip to Afghanistan, during which time I worked on two priorities. One was to implement the field study portion of the Measure of Progress report. I trained our team of six Afghan interviewers, three men and three women, to conduct 1,000 qualitative interviews across the country, asking Afghans about the impact that they felt in their lives and the changes they see in their communities. Simultaneously, I conducted my own interviews. I met with over 200 people, Afghan government officials, international donor country officials, multilateral institutions, NGOs, and various cross-sections of Afghan society. I was luckier than most in Afghanistan. I was able to travel without significant security restrictions or guards, and was able to experience the Afghan street in a way that they were not able to. I used a local car, beat-up Toyota Corolla, and I took commercial airways. I also look Afghan, as most people came and spoke to me in Dari before they realized that I was actually an international, which allowed me to get on the street more than internationals are able to these days, and walk the markets and pull aside people that I wanted to ask questions to. So that gives you a little bit of the sense of how I was traveling when I was out there. We're still a few months from issuing final recommendations, pulling together our analysis, and writing up a report from you guys. But as Rick said, this is such a timely issue, especially with Karzai coming here today or tomorrow. So I wanted to provide you with my first impressions. I will start off with three broad findings and then illustrate my points with some of the opinions and perceptions of Afghans that I spoke with, internationals I spoke with, as well as my own observations and perceptions. One, optimism in Afghanistan is deteriorating. Two, our funds and projects are not prioritizing Afghan needs. And three, our development strategy needs to be better balanced. One, optimism is shifting to pessimism. We found in our 2005 study that Afghan people tend to be more optimistic than other sources that we used for evaluation work, like the media and the public official documents, even academic research. Our findings from that study last year showed that Afghans had seen significant change in their lives over the past 3 years. They were hopeful that the government was building the capacity to meet their needs in the future. However, today we should be worried. Optimism is dissipating. It seems clear when speaking to people living and working in the country that Afghans are becoming rapidly disillusioned while waiting for the benefits promised to them from the new democratic Afghanistan. They nervously watch the security situation in the south deteriorate and increasingly are feeling isolated from government officials and international actors that make decisions that affect their lives. Most worrisome is that Afghans are beginning to doubt that the government will build the capacity and indeed even have the will to implement programs to improve their lives in the long term. So some examples to talk about this deteriorating pessimism is that at the same time that the government and the international actors are working to build capacity within the center, the government is actually losing legitimacy in the eyes of many Afghans. Corruption and nepotism, you've heard this, is on the rise. And this is to be expected to some degree, but I think Afghans are reaching the limits to the level of corruption they will endure before they start to lose faith in the government system as a whole. A more critical constraint to good governance that I heard over and over again was the re-legitimization of government officials that are connected to criminal networks or illegitimate warlords or plain ineffective. I heard about that there were, the last estimate that I heard was that there are about 120 ministers without portfolios, essentially without a function. And many of them have been removed from official posts through other processes and institutions, like the parliament rejecting Mr. Shinwari, the chief justice. And others were removed under international pressure, like the former governor of Helmand. But Karzai has brought them back into the folds of the government under new titles and with new positions. Last year, our findings indicated that the Afghans supported the central government, and mostly they supported the central government because they had faith in Karzai. They saw him as a fair and honest broker. But they're watching this reshuffling very carefully, and it's affecting the optimism they had in Karzai. It's affecting their optimism they have in the central government. Most people agree, on the street that I spoke with, that during the Pran process, it was necessary to make concessions with leaders of different ethnic groups, with leaders with different power centers in order to form the new government and bring people together and decrease the incentives for fighting. But today, the Afghans that I spoke with, I mean, from all ethnic backgrounds, from all regions that I traveled to, want to see Karzai clamp down on the impunity. And the government has been painfully complacent on this. There's an anti-corruption commission, which I tried very hard to get into and speak with some people there. They have not yet taken on a case. The Ministry of Narcotics and the Deputy Director of the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission told me that they've got names of hundreds of people, many of them government officials, that are involved in the drug trade and human rights abuses. Yet the names have not been disclosed and the evidence has not been followed up on. The Ministry of Interior, responsible for appointing hundreds of government administrators and police officials across the country, particularly has been criticized for not taking action within its own ranks. Pessimism is also very apparent in the justice sector. It remains the most criticized pillar, as it did last year, according to our findings from last year. The Afghans cite corrupt judges and prosecutors as being the principal reason why they don't trust the formal systems. One Afghan who had a property case in the court for 3 years and running told me, if your issues refer to the judicial officials, you should check your pockets first. Economic insecurity is also fueling pessimism. It is rising and has driven Afghans to engage in anti-government behaviors. One of our interviewers explained to me very calmly, the biggest security problem, particularly in the South, is unemployment and poverty. Afghans unable to work are more likely to set off IDs and join the Taliban, the fighting ranks of the Taliban, just to receive cash to survive. And in the rural areas, income is also becoming more and more difficult to come by as poppy eradication is diminishing income to farmers. One poppy farmer in Jalalabad told me that, I grow poppy because my stomach's family requires it. Until the government makes good on its promises to provide us with infrastructure to grow something else, I will continue to grow it. Larger investment in projects, water projects and roads to market, storage facilities, access to credits against next year's harvest. These are the kinds of services and infrastructure that needs to be built in order to provide economic opportunities for Afghans and discourage them from and encourage them to support the government, discourage them from these anti-government behaviors. Reports have shown insecurity. It's a bit of a mixed bag. Reports have shown that the Taliban have grown in significantly in size and that they're using new tactics since they have greater strength than they did last year. But I think what's more worrisome in terms of how the Afghan street feels is the growing level of support that the Taliban is gaining in the South. They are also hoping to win hearts and minds, and they're providing an alternative to the government in some ways. They've relaxed their rules that they enforced in the past. Women can leave the house, men are shaving their beards, and TV is watched and enjoyed. Radio is heard on the streets. And so, you know, the Taliban are trying to find ways to reach out to the people and win their support today. One of the biggest things that they're doing is offering protection against eradication forces, the government eradication forces, thereby convincing many Afghans that they care more about their economic well-being than the government officials do. They're beginning to administer in some districts in Helmand, solving judicial cases. I heard about four separate judicial cases that have been outstanding in the courts for a number of years that the Taliban solved. It shows that they are more capable than the government's judges. So for those that cannot be won over, intimidation and fear is being used by the Taliban. Two of our interviewers, actually, from Southern District and Helmand that were doing interviews in Kandahar and Helmand, became IDPs midway through our project and moved their entire family over to Herat after the Taliban had entered the village. And they were not alone. They estimated that another 400 families had left from their district and neighboring districts. So the Taliban is providing an alternative, and I think the way we should look at it is that diminishing support for the government is translating into growing support for the Taliban. There are gains. Gains have been made in the social sector. There is optimism from the ability to send the children their children to school, from clinics being more widely available. But we must be careful not to equate an increase in quantity of services with success in and of itself. Quality, long-term sustainability, accessibility, particularly in regions off the beaten track and for women, weighs more heavily in the minds of Afghans than number of buildings built and number of schools operational. The joy of my day was to see the hundreds of women and hundreds of girls that would walk the streets in Kabul and all the other cities, all dressed the same, off to school and returning, and it was this constant flux, and it really made my day to see it. Construction work happening in regional hospitals, increasing the number of beds and the number of people that can be cared for in each of them. But, you know, we need to temper our joy to some degree. As one Afghan NGO worker actually said to me, "You've constructed the school buildings, but now who's going to pay the teacher salaries? You've built the clinics, but who will pay for the equipment and medicines?" She explained to me that the government needs to find incentives to move the qualified personnel outside of the village, outside of the cities, and into the district centers, into the villages, so that people can actually get access to them. Until then, she concluded, there is no value to these services. This kind of sounds like a bleak picture, so I'm going to move on to the next point, which is that our money and programs are not sufficiently prioritizing Afghan needs. Afghan expectations have grown immensely. It is no longer sufficient for their lives to be better off than they were during the Taliban years or for them to be better off during the Civil War. Now they're looking for changes in their life that correlate with the level of resources that have entered the country and with the level of attention the international community is giving the country. The sentiment I heard most often was, it has been 5 years, billions of dollars are spent, where has this money gone? Why has nothing changed? It's hard to debate the sentiment when you count the numbers. You know, of the total money spent by the international community, about $80 billion was spent on military operations and about $7 on reconstruction. And a majority of that is going into paying the salaries of Afghan national forces, counter-narcotic efforts, and a large amount of this is being tied and coming back into the Western nations. You know, the amount that is actually going into on-the-ground projects that are benefiting ordinary Afghans is a fraction of what we're spending. This is also compounded by the inability of the government to spend even 50% of its development budget on programs to benefit Afghans. Despite rhetoric, money is not being targeted to meet the needs that they find to be most critical for their livelihoods. Their priorities must be brought back into the national building process. Some of these priorities that I heard out there was an effective judicial system. An effective judicial system could combat the impunity, which not only fuels the insecurity and the bad governance, but will also raise the optimism that the Afghans feel in their central government. The programs that have been implemented have in the justice sector have focused largely on surface changes, such as providing judges with better offices or constructing bigger court buildings. Often this is because they're asking the judges what they need as opposed to the people using the judicial system what they need, improvements they need. A lot more attention needs to be paid to the justice sector for a number of reasons. The sheer number of cases has exploded. As one judge told me, it has been 10, 15 years since there's been a formal institution that can decide cases on the crimes that were committed during that time. All those cases are coming through the door today at one time. And so there's a backlog of cases that need to be handled, and therefore it's particularly important to be able to create transitional mechanisms or ways to sort of funnel this backlog. Over the past few decades, there have been changing patterns of crime, such as the emergence of war crimes, land grab, human and child trafficking is becoming a problem. Organized crime is, of course, with the drug trade is also another changing type of case that's coming into the system. Also, there's changing social demographics. There's IDPs, disabled, women-headed households, and all these changes means that the judicial sector is confronting new legal issues and the laws, procedures, codes of context, training, all needs to be reoriented to reflect the cases that come into system. It's not enough to just do things better or try and streamline. They need to be rethought, and it will take time. In the meantime, we have traditional informal mechanisms that hold a lot of weight in the minds of Afghans and are very legitimate, and they should be tied into the state. We should find ways to have the two systems complement each other. Job opportunities and income. I heard it over and over again is another critical Afghan need that's not being addressed sufficiently. Most of the Afghan fighters, like I said, that are joining the Taliban leadership are joining for economic rather than ideological reasons. As eradication continues and development slows because the security constraints are making it more and more difficult for NGOs and implementers to get in to the areas that are insecure, job opportunities are deteriorating. In a personal way, I see the job creation as being critical to counterinsurgency and counter-narcotic effort. They're tied together. This is not everywhere. In the cities of Herat, Mazar, and Jalalabad, in the north and the west, private businesses are booming. There's small shops and businesses. Markets are operating and are busy. Import-export trade is on the rise with neighboring countries, and it is creating new opportunities. In these areas, clinics and more schools are no longer the priority, and our development strategies in those areas should be focused more heavily on long-term economic business development, better infrastructure such as predictable and affordable power sources, roads to bring raw materials from other cities and from across the borders and to carry products out to the market. These would reduce operating costs for businesses and provide the environment for them to grow. The banking industry is kind of an upshot. It's been growing, providing entrepreneurs with capital they need to start up. But liquidity is not yet blanket widely available in the country. When capital is available, it's often done on short-term basis, 1 or 2 years, and at a very high interest rate. So it makes it difficult for the businesses to plan for the long term. Lastly, the legal framework in which businesses register and operate have improved thanks to some institutions such as the AICC, the International Chamber of Commerce, ISA, the Investment Support Agency Agency Support. But unclear land titles and rights are continuing to discourage investment. There are industrial development zones that I saw, one of them in Herat, and there are plots there that are available for business development, and they have tax breaks, and they provide a lot of incentives for businesses to set up factories in those areas, but a lot of them are not being built on because there's disputes about who owns them, when they bought them, and these need to be sorted out in order to encourage greater growth in the economic sector. The international spend most of its fund on security forces, on their own security, on the military operations, the Afghans I spoke to saw the value in this. They see the international forces presence as being necessary to maintaining the peace, fighting the Taliban, at least up until the point that the ANA can take over those functions. I don't think that they see this money as being badly spent. One Afghan worried to me, if Americans leave, would the war start again? I think they know the value of it. But there are negative perceptions of the international forces within the population. And most of that can be attributed to partnership with local warlords, rising civilian casualties, believe it or not, reckless driving in Kabul, like in the riots, which being in a beat-up Toyota Corolla, trust me, they roll right by you without paying attention to you being on the road. So it is quite of an aggressive driving habit over there, and it puts people on edge. Also, there's a lack of sufficient reconstruction work by PRTs. A lot of the PRTs see their work as being stabilization, going out and doing patrols, and not fully reconstruction, but that's what the Afghans are expecting of them. Maybe it's the title, maybe it's the way they were sold to the Afghans, but I think they want to see that the PRT is more willing to get on the ground and do projects for them. The international community has prioritized infrastructure development. Roads have been one of the biggest things on the agenda, communication. Lots of money has gone to these areas, to infrastructure, and I find myself wondering, I think, as many Afghans do, why it's taking so long. Power, power, power. I heard it over and over and over again. People want power. They say that they have the same or less than when they did 5 years ago. So, you know, as people wait for the promise of power, they're becoming disillusioned, and they're starting to believe that their priorities are not even being listened to. I mean, it's almost impossible to go to the country and not figure out that power is a priority in the minds of Afghans. Also, some roads have been built, like the highways, the Kabul-Mazar Highway, which was nice and smooth. I traveled many of these highways. Yet within the city of Mazar, the third largest, is the city roads felt like I was driving through the desert or through a village. I mean, there's four major roads, and the rest of it is still unpaved and quite rocky. The Kabul-Bamyan Highway has been part of that province's development agenda for since the beginning, and it still takes 10 hours to drive from Kabul to Bamyan, a place that if it was paved, it would take 2 to 3, and connect this quite inaccessible provincial center to Kabul, allowing them to have more reconstruction presence, to allow them to engage in trade with the city center, and basically uplift this area. Often because of funding and delivery constraints, we are doing many infrastructure projects, but they're small, quick impact, and very limited in scope. We build wells for drinking water in some district areas, but they reach only into the first aquifer, as opposed to the third, where the supply of water is the most. We deepen some of the canals, but we're not actually looking at the entire irrigation system and creating a holistic revitalization plan. There are some effective mechanisms for delivery, for reconstruction, ways that we can hear those needs and hear those priorities of Afghans, one being the National Solidarity Program, in which elected Shura members determine the priorities and monitor the implementation of projects. These were, in my mind, an extremely successful project in Afghanistan. They're seen as being legitimate bodies to most Afghans, and they're close enough to the people to make programmatic choices based on the needs in their community. But they're at the village level, so they're not at the district level, and they don't cover larger projects. So what we're starting to see is a lot of councils, these NSP councils, teaming together with other districts and villages near them to build larger projects. And I think this is an initiative that could be supported. Third, I wanted to talk about a balanced development strategy. It's a bit controversial, I think, and there's a lot of questions about how our strategy should be implemented in Afghanistan, and how we should think about the best way to be able to provide a whole country with the number, you know, the infinite number of things that need to happen. But, you know, I think we need to balance our programming, focusing not only on the places that are the worst off, that have the greatest need, but also focus on the places that we can do work. Focus at the places where there is support for the government, where there is security to go in, where some projects have laid the groundwork for longer-term projects, deeper projects. You know, I think the security problems in this are largely focused in the South. They are not countrywide. I think that's important to remember when we think about our development strategy. The critical need in the South is to stabilize the provinces in Helmand, Kandahar, Oruzgan, Zabul. Aid agencies are increasingly unwilling and unable to carry out reconstruction and development work. The government is unable to get out there and deliver services because there's a security risk of leaving the provincial center and sometimes even his own house. So yet the assistance money, a majority of the assistance money or a lot of the assistance money is carefully set aside for these provinces, for the areas where the insurgency and the power of the Taliban is highest, where poppy production, as we heard from UNDC's recent report, has increased exponentially, and where, frankly, the support for the mission and the government within the people is the lowest. To Afghans in the north, in the west, in the east, the Afghans that are waiting for roads and reconstruction to come to their province, it's as if the international community is rewarding people for anti-government behavior. In Nangarhar in the east, the people are demanding a mix of humanitarian projects and job creation programs. Education is strong. There's potential for economic growth, particularly through the trade with Afghanistan. In my mind, the East is a critical theater. It's a transit state. Weapons and people move seamlessly through the borders. Trade moves seamlessly through the borders. And although there are not yet significant security problems like there are in the South and in the East, we need to pay attention to this area. The security of Jalalabad is directly linked to the security of Kabul. In these areas, poppy production was eliminated and is now reemerging. Support for the government is, especially the provincial government, is high, but it's waning. And I think that the people in the East have been promised alternative livelihoods, they've been promised infrastructure, and these promises are not being kept because sufficient development money is not going into keep the promises that have been made to the people that are agreeing to follow the initiatives that the government has laid out. And more money should be spent doing that. In Mazar and Herat, the security situation is stable, and people no longer need the quick-impact humanitarian projects. They want long-term initiatives for governance improvement. They want economic growth opportunities. They want investment. In the inaccessible provinces, roads have to be built, like I said, to connect the provinces to centers where benefits can be taken advantage of. In Bamyan, it's kind of a sick joke, but in Bamyan there was a bitter joke I heard out there, which was, we need more aid. Maybe we should pick up guns, attack some internationals, and grow some poppy. Clearly, we need to rethink the way that we are communicating and the way we are spending our money and also communicating to the Afghans the work we're doing. Some of the assistance money should be diverted to these places where it can have impact and where it can show the benefits that the benefits that come with good behavior. I don't advocate that the South should lose all development funds writ large, but we should realize it is a live combat area, and it's difficult to reconstruct and develop and have long-term strategies for livelihood improvement when there's fighting on the ground. As one Afghan, Pashtun Afghan from Helmand told me, what good are new roads and radios if the Taliban are controlling them? We need security first, then we'll talk development. The regions where security situation allows NGOs and contractors to work, where people support the government, despite having seen much reconstruction work, they need to be uplifted. The PRTs can be an able mechanism for implementation of projects. Changes need to be made to the model, I think. I visited a number of PRTs during my trip. I tried to hit them in every region I went to, every province I went to. One development officer, told me that they're only able to implement small-time Band-Aid projects, is what she called it, Band-Aid projects. Another said that they were constantly crisis managing and not really rebuilding. These PRTs need to be given the flexibility to be able to decide the mix of military and civilian activities that need to occur. And they need to be given the funding, frankly, to undertake longer-term, larger projects when necessary. Part of the constraints to doing this is that the development and reconstruction funds and personnel vary from PRT to PRT. So does the level of commitment and the philosophy of the lead donor organization. And, so decisions are being made not depending on the needs assessment or security assessment of what that province, what are the priorities for that province, but rather they're being determined at the top by the embassies. And often this also leads to an unbalanced development. What you get is in the regions and the provinces where the lead donor has the money and has the commitment and the willingness to spend more money on reconstruction, they tend to have a positive impact and the people see the benefit of the PRT, while others where the philosophy is different or where the funds are different remain woefully behind in what the PRT can provide. National governance structures also make it difficult to devise strategies that are attuned to local needs and that are balanced across the country. The center still retains the monopoly on decision making, and deconstructing the power from the center to provincial levels would allow those government officials that are closest to the provinces and closest to the people to determine the development plans. I also heard talk of potentially providing them with the control of the budget so that they can spend money on the priorities of their province and improve the government's ability writ large to be able to undertake development work according to the needs of Afghans. So just to back off a little bit, you know, just reiterate that my overall impressions of Afghans, of Afghanistan today is that expectations have not been met, and Afghans are starting to doubt whether the nation-building project is going to work. Primarily, this is because Afghan needs are not being identified and prioritized. And although some gains have been made in education, communication, private sector growth, and roads, big issues that were there at the beginning of the intervention still remain, like what to do with the warlords, what to do with the poppy, what to do with the support for the Taliban, how to provide economic development in areas with limited access and little infrastructure and security constraints. Development has been largely unbalanced, focused on the areas that have the largest problems, and our funding mechanism and implementation models need to be flexible enough to meet the diverse needs and the changing needs of each province. You know, in my view, the decreasing optimism is likely to have major consequences for the security and the level of support for the government. There's a growing sense that the international commitment is not genuine, long-term, or what it needs to be to succeed. Conspiracy theories are rampant, particularly in the South. And you know, the Afghans may not be the only ones who are beginning to doubt the viability of the project. You know, reading the news, the difficulty that NATO had securing much-needed troops, rifts between the U.S. government and the Karzai government, and the countless internationals I spoke to on the ground that said that their budgets are shrinking. You know, all seem to point towards the idea that maybe international community commitment is also waning. Maybe we are also becoming a bit disillusioned. But I think this would be a tragedy because today there's not only a need for more resources and a stronger commitment, but there's a need to reprioritize, rethink our strategies, and really engage with the Afghans in a way that we have not in the past. Thank you.
Thanks, Seema. You certainly covered a great number of issues here, which I suspect is going to provoke a lot of questions and comments. When you stand up to ask a question, would you just please let us know who you are and what organization you come from, and we'll call you right away. I guess we have a microphone. Sherry, why don't we bring that forward? We'll start with you here, and then we'll go to you there. And are you working this side, Sasha? You're working, Steve. Steve, why don't you start with this woman right here, please? Great.
Thank you very much. Carola Vile, U.S. Institute of Peace. I was very interested in your report. I just came back from Pakistan doing a similar kind of exercise, though. It was very helpful to see what it looks like on the other side of the border. I just wonder if you could speak a little bit more about the donors and the internationals and to what degree there are differences both in the way in which Afghans perceive the different internationals and activities on the part of the donors. Is the imbalance that you speak of across the board? Are there differences? Are there some things that are being done better or worse by particular national donors, private donors, however it is? If you could give us a little bit more of a picture, a more fine-tuned picture, perhaps, if you can. Thank you.
Sure.
Do you want to take a few questions, or do you want to do one at a time?
No, maybe we should take
take a handful?
Let's take a few.
Why don't we take three or four questions, and then we can perhaps get an essay going.
Warren Merrick, Information for Democracy, and I was a former case officer involved in the Afghan-Soviet War. And I returned from Afghanistan on my own, a private trip, early this year, and there was a lot of enthusiasm from the American military about the Afghan National Army. And I look at this, and it looks like you didn't get to interview any Afghan National Army officers or soldiers. Could you comment on that?
Yeah.
Well, you two more. There's one right behind you, and then this gentleman right down here, Sasha. Go ahead.
Jim Doroth, Office of Military Affairs, USAID. I'm interested in the PRTs. I'm curious to find out how effective or what you got from your surveys around PRTs.
I think.
Is this a PRT
question too, or is this?
Hi, Seema. I'm Mike McNerney, Department of Defense. And in terms of the application of the conclusions you came to, I remember when Secretary Rumsfeld had his famous quote about we don't even know if we're winning or losing in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that came out to our office where we started a sort of a metrics effort that eventually built into a huge group of people with 78 slides issued every week and tracking all sorts of things. And I was in the early phase of that. We never did polling. I think your methodology is much better than what we were able to do because we didn't have the authority to go out and do what you did. But
nor the resources that we have.
Nor the powerful resources that CSIS can bring to bear. What I think now is the next set of problems is you seem to have done a really good job of getting to some conclusions. Now the trick is applying them so that there are specific changes in the way we do things. And I think we know there's not going to be a dramatic increase in the level of assistance, and so there's going to be tough choices. So do you cut, you know, your support for ANA training to get at some of this reconstruction work? Do you cut what's in the south to get at the east? And I don't know if AID is working with you on sort of specific policy applications.
Let me, Seema, just give you another minute to think about it. Let me just jump in for a second here. When we made our recommendations a year ago, we were working on the assumption that the assistance was inevitably going to fall off. We were also working on the assumption that we had been quite successful up to now, and the hardest thing to do is to make change when you think you're doing well, when you think you're on a winning streak. But we did, in fact, identify the moment and the reason we called our report In the Balance, and it took quite a lot, as Morgan, who is the lead author, will recognize, it took a lot of discussion to come to that point, is that we recognized that we really did have to change the way we were making the approach to Afghanistan. Now it's going to be, the irony of this is it may be easier to make changes now when people are worried, as opposed to a year ago when people thought, yeah, you know, we've done pretty well. But part of what we said a year ago was that we had spent 3 years doing things that we were quite familiar with and we did well. Fight a war, returning refugees, humanitarian assistance, build stuff. And now we had to make all those things work. So now we've had a year where the Afghans are wondering, gee, how come things aren't working as well as they were during the Taliban period or during the Civil War? Now, those are not good comparison moments because those are considered extremely low moments in the landscape. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that another element of our methodology that we've really tried to the reason we got started on this was that we felt that many, many, many people who do measurement tend to look at it from the perspective of what they are doing, from their own activities, their own inputs, and oftentimes their own outputs. And we saw many of the measures that were being used by the U.S. government fell into that category, a lot of effort measurements. And so what we tried to do was to say, well, ultimately, it is in the minds of the people of the place as to whether you've been successful or not. So how can we try to figure out what the people are feeling and finding? And so while this is a little bit of we sort of call it a bouillabaisse of a model, it does have, you know, a lot of different ingredients which try to get at what are the people thinking. So those are some, just speaking to some of the points. Okay, I hope that gave you enough time.
Sure. Yeah, I want to follow up a little bit on that, which is that, you know, the way I sort of looked at it when I was down there and was talking to people, I mean, I did a number of interviews or meetings really to try and lay the groundwork with different working groups and consultative groups in the country so that when we do come back with findings, we're not just handing them a report, but we can actually do debriefs and get in and talk about the issues that they find most important, give them the evidence on their particular sectors or topics. You know, with the ANDS process, the National Development Strategy process that's being undertaken in Afghanistan, there is monitoring of that kind of stuff, whether we are meeting the benchmarks of the activities that we've laid out to do. And, you know, in my mind, there needs to be two. That is extremely important just to make sure that we're staying on track, that, you know, that we are meeting the goals that we've set out for Afghans, I mean, for the projects that we're delivering to Afghans, but on maybe instead of a weekly basis or bi-weekly basis, where we can provide a qualitative assessment of how Afghans are seeing the impact of this. And in terms of methodological differences, there are there, and I think both are equally valuable. Definitely, we are, you know, there are surveys being conducted, the military is trying to conduct in the country. They're quite good, but they're all pre-laid out, you know, what are the five answers that you can pick from? And we provide this qualitative assessment, which gives it a different spin. But, you know, in terms of our plans for trying to get the decision-making to actually change based on the findings that we have, I think it's important to get those networks. I mean, in Afghanistan, you know someone, that's how things happen. So, you know, to get the networks in place so that we can go in, we can brief them on the specific issues, give them the information, and try and allow some of those changes to, you know, at least the decision makers to bridge the gap between the decision makers and what the people are saying, essentially. PRTs. I had a lot of opinions on the PRTs that I went out there. Like I said in my speech, I think that they can be a very effective mechanism, but they need to be changed. They're this sort of this project in civil military affairs and CIMIC operations, and most of them have, you know, hundreds of military personnel and then two or three development guys. It's largely unbalanced, and it's, you know, that might make sense in the South, but in the South the Canadians are putting in large amounts of reconstruction people and less security people, which doesn't seem to make sense when you look at the needs of the provinces themselves. And I think to some extent there needs to be, you know, the PRTs, they're trying to create greater coherence and codes of conduct. There are handbooks out there now that NATO's making for PRT coherence, but they need to also insert flexibility to be able to do needs assessment and change their programs from this. And this becomes very difficult because even the development guys can't get outside of the wire without force protection. So if the development guy is going to meetings to talk to the local government official, he's going with, in a tank. And so, you know, it really makes goes to show how difficult it is to do reconstruction work side and side with the military in that way. But if it is going to happen, what needs to, you know, if the model is going to work, and I believe it can, in most provinces, in a lot of provinces, they're the only ones there. And so if they can't do the reconstruction work, who will? And so we need to make sure that they build, you know, they have the right personnel, civil engineers, if they're going to build something, rather than force protection. You know, those kind of decision-making power needs to be handed down to the people on the ground rather than the embassies or NATO headquarters, and that flexibility needs to be put into the process. The ANA, no, you're right. I wasn't able to actually interview any ANA soldiers, per se. I tried once or twice to get onto their camp under various guises to look at their communication strategy and things like that, but I was unable to. But I did hear a lot of what people said about the ANA. And, the people's, I think people have a lot of faith in the ANA. They see them as being a legitimate force of Afghans that are willing to go out there and provide security. They don't have all the equipment they need, communication equipment, often even weaponry that they need to be able to do the types of jobs that they're doing. But the legitimacy is high, and I think that's important to that lesson should be learned as we start to think about how to change the perceptions of the ANP. And the ANP is known to be very corrupt, anti-Islamic. I heard oftentimes they drink, they engage in bad behaviors, and the people don't trust them largely. Whatever we did right in the ANA in terms of building legitimacy and their value in the eyes of Afghans, we should look to those lessons from building the ANP. Another interesting kind of controversial thing that's coming up the pipelines is this auxiliary police, local policing forces that are expected to, that they plan on putting in police uniforms and having them fight alongside a sort of a quasi-government police force. This started because of the interest that Karzai had in saying, when Karzai said about a couple months ago, a month before I left, that we need something in these communities. If we can't get enough police there, we need to provide them with some sort of security mechanism. I spoke to some internationals that were working on police reform and that were working on ANA reform. And I find this to be, we need to think about this very carefully. There could be a lot of delegitimization of what is essentially a very traditional mechanism. Local community policing has been around for centuries in Afghanistan, where, you know, each family provides one of their sons to be sort of to serve on certain days to police the community. And by putting them in police uniforms, most of the police that's being seen as illegitimate can create all kinds of negative tension here. So I think we need to be a little bit careful about what the auxiliary police are and how we use them. And this goes to a bigger point, I think, which is that for all the different activities that we undertake in Afghanistan, there's a break between the communication. And local Afghans need to be told when things are coming, why we're making the decisions we're making. There needs to be like a communication strategy, a strategic communication strategy. And I know one is coming up the pipelines, you know, as part of the initiatives that Karzai has set up with this policy action group process, which is to sort of combat the problems in the South. But, you know, I think this is extremely critical because, for an example, when I was in Bamyan speaking to the local Afghans, the Hazaras in Bamyan, they said the PRT is not doing anything. And I went to the PRT and I saw lists and projects and things happening in different districts and went, traveled to some of them, saw the wells, saw the canals. But the information is just getting lost along the way between what's happening and what the Afghans are hearing about. Partly it's because, as the international community, we're still trying to figure out what's happening. We're still trying to draw the big picture. But those databases that are out there, there's ISAF is completing a data, and all these are public, and it took me a while to find them, but now, you know, I want to share them with everyone because they're extremely valuable. But ISAF has a GIS system, maps out where the schools are in the whole country. You know, a picture like that, when the provincial governor, when somebody tells the provincial governor you have not done anything, if he can show a picture like that, it helps his own communication strategy. It helps the way people view him and the work he's doing. And this kind of branding needs to happen. This kind of branding of the mission needs to happen in order for the benefits to be realized, I think, in the minds of Afghans. Last question was on the donors. How different donors are viewed, who's doing it right. It's a good question for everybody, I think. You know, what I heard on the street are that there are donors that people view as being quite good. Afghans view as being honest, fair, you know, conscious of their own needs, and those are, you know, some of the older NGOs, I mean, the older donors that have been there forever, so the Swedes, the Danish, the ones that stuck around during the bad times, I think that still carries over in the minds that they never left us, and that still holds value to them. JICA, Japan, is very highly celebrated out there. Partly, I think, it's because they're not actually tied to any military function. So I think part of that is going to happen naturally because they don't have armed people in the country. But I think JICA has picked two or three programs, and they're doing them all well. And they've picked two or three areas, and they're doing them well. I mean, they're not trying to cover the blanket. That's not their role in the country. It's not like the U.S., who has to do a lot more blanket, you know, projects and things like that. So, but they tend to be very streamlined. They focus on the roads that are the critical roads in their province, and they implement well. So, I think that they have a lot of value. I mean, to some extent, it's I think a given that the U.S. is going to be pointed at and targeted the most as a donor in the types of projects we're doing. But, you know, the projects, a lot of the USAID projects tend to be very long-term. They tend to be capacity-building type projects. And it takes time to build that up, you know, to build those projects up. They're not quick impact. They're not roads. They're not so much the visible results that some of the other donors are doing. But at the same time, USAID has not communicated its strategy to the Afghans people. They're not providing enough information about what's being done. They're not, you know, getting out there. There's billboards that say USAID built this project for you, but it's not seeping into the minds, I think, fully. I don't know if you want to say more about the USAID donor.
Why don't we just, another some more questions here. Why don't we just go one at a time? Well, lots of them. So ask a quick question.
Maybe I'll keep them shorter.
We'll ask Seema to, if you can keep your question sure. under a minute, we'll ask her to keep her answer under 2 minutes. And it looks like there are 10 that we'll take. So let's go and just work our way around. Sasha, you find the, you pick your next person.
There's one right here.
Sure.
Sasha, there's one right here that looks eager. Yeah. Okay.
Please go ahead.
If you permit me an opportunity to make a couple of comments. My name is Robert Jimenez. I was the program officer for USAID in Afghanistan for over 3 years. So I think I have a little background on what you saw and what you perceive. I applaud what you're doing and what you did. Perceptions are what are important. And I agree with you that one of the major failures of the U.S. government and all the international donors has been the ability to manage expectations. Those are the people in Afghanistan, and to have a proper way of getting out to them the information as to what's being accomplished and how long things are going to take.
Yeah.
But just a couple of comments, because the methodology you're using didn't allow you to get all of the information you needed because of the period of time you were working. But you made a comment about JICA and the roads. The Japanese had 50 kilometers of the Kabul, Kandahar Road. The U.S. had 450.
Yeah.
In the period of time that we took to build the 450, the Japanese still had failed to complete their 50, and we had to go back in and help to assist them so that the ribbon could be cut at the proper time when the whole piece finished. The road up to Bamiyan was taken on by the Italians. They chose that as their project, and instead of developing a program in which they were going to control and manage it, they merely provided the funds to the Ministry of Public Works, and so they were using an old system that had failed before, and that's why you still don't have a road into Bamiyan.
Yeah.
On the PRTs, there was a sizable amount of resources that were put into the PRTs to help those development people that were put in there. It was over $60 million. It's not chump change. And they did assessments, and they had to have the approval at the district and the province level before a project would be funded. And then it came back through to the Ministry of Ministries in Kabul. And you're right, the central government is preventing the growth because of the stranglehold they have. But eventually they went back down, and so it was done with the wishes of the people as to what they needed. And there's a lot of good projects out there. They just were not able to tell the people what had been done.
Just a quick comment on that, which is that when they are, it's had incredible benefits. I mean, in Jalalabad, the USAID PRTs, which, to be frank, I think the USAID's got a nice, a good mix, more than some of the other ones I went to, and are more willing to engage in reconstruction activities. But in Jalalabad, I had heard that, you know, I was told by a number of different Afghans kind of in the market that, did you see the road when you were driving in? That was built by our governor. The PRT helped him. And that kind of, I mean, and that, and there is good support for the governor there because they see him as being a manager who can get things done, who can get international funding. But, you know, I think that that's really, that speaks to the essence of what we're looking for, is for the attribution to be to the governor with the support of the international community. And it does build a lot of well-being, I think, in the minds of Afghans when they know how the project happened and who did it. And
you know. Thank you. My name is Astrid Sürke. I work with the Research Institute in Norway, and we have a program in Afghanistan. And I just happened to be in town, so I thought I'll take advantage of this very interesting talk. Thank you. My question takes off from what you said about the Japanese as a donor, that they are well regarded, perhaps because you said they don't have a military presence. Now, if that is true, then the logic of the PRT, of course, makes no sense. Which leads me to the larger question. In your survey, did you include systematically questions regarding attitude towards foreign forces?
Sorry?
Towards foreign forces, presence of foreign soldiers.
Yeah.
Because, of course, in Afghanistan's history, that is a controversial subject.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some anecdotal evidence which suggests that there is increasing hostility towards foreign forces, partly because of the nature of the warfare in the south and the displacement of people and the casualties, and not only of the civilians. We had a group of Afghans at our institute a couple of weeks ago, and they said what Karzai also has said, that the Taliban are also Afghans. So there is a sense of the widespread casualty that seems to be gaining concern. And related to that, and my final point, do you have any sense of how people in the north view the progress of Taliban in the south? Because that goes back to all the memories of a civil war between the north, the northern-based groups and the Taliban. Thank you.
It should take you at least 10 seconds.
10 seconds. On the PRT, you know, the PRT, the presence of military in reconstruction, is the PRT model is important because they're going to places where the Japanese won't and where international donors won't. I mean, it's one thing when they're set up in Mazar or Jalalabad, but for the ones that are, you know, out in Baghdis, that are in the places where there are not international donors, you need some kind of model to be able to get them there. Now, whether the PRT is always the right one is debatable, I think, and I think it depends on the security situation in the province, and shouldn't be assumed that it's the only model that's for doing civil-military work. Attitude of the presence of foreign forces. Our survey will speak to that. We have not gotten our translations back, so I don't want to make any blanket statements about how Afghans feel about foreign forces. But, you know, my gut sense after speaking with many Afghans is that that the foreign forces are kind of it's a necessity. It's an unwanted necessity. You know, it's something that we need to have in the time being, because without them, we might go back to the civil war. We don't know who's got power right now in the country, whether it's Karzai, whether it's Taliban, whether it's warlords still. And so I think they see them as a buffer. I don't know if this is true. I mean, I wouldn't be able to say, because I imagine to a large degree there are regional differences, provincial differences, ethnic differences on the way people view the foreign forces. But we will provide information on that in our findings. The northern people's view of the Taliban, I think they're worried. I think they see security as being good in their areas. They've got some localized fighting still between tribal and former commanders mostly over resources and things like that. But they look at the south and they get worried that the insurgency is going to spread to their areas. I don't really know how to say this. I think Afghans are really used to seeing the future in an if. If something happens, then something, you know, it's not a definitive. They say, if we can't stop the government, how can we do, you know, how, what will it look? I mean, if we can't stop the Taliban, they might come here. But I don't think any definitives are in their minds about the strength of the Taliban coming into the area. I think that they're willing to fight against it. If it does.
Thanks, Seema. I think we're really good answers to the very probing questions, as usual, Astrid. Nice to have you here. Nice to see you again. Why don't we just pick? You've got somebody right there. This gentleman here. Do you have? Go ahead. Right there. You're right there. Go for it. Yeah.
Jerry Becker, Development Alternatives Incorporated. I worked on NSP from the beginning as a team leader at one point. Mm-hmm. One of its main objectives was to reach out to as many communities as they could in all the districts to prove to the Afghans that they will provide reconstruction. We've gone out to at least half of the communities already.
Yeah.
But that plus your rather bleak assessment. Are the common Afghan, are they convinced that they really need a national government? They've not had a national government for a couple decades, a real national government. So are they really convinced now that they need a national government and not the local governments and tribal governments that they used to have?
Should we take one or two more?
Go ahead. Why don't you
okay.
Hit that one out.
Okay. It's good to hear you worked on it. I'm going to come ask you more questions later, because I really enjoyed watching the NSP project. You know, I went to oversight consultants that are responsible for sort of the procedural and the monitoring of it. I talked to SURA members that are part of the CDC councils to ask them about the program. You know, they have reached a lot of communities, and to combat it with my bleak picture, you know, I think you're right. I think that we need to take a step back and do look at some of the successes that have been made, especially on this grassroots community level. You know, wells have been built, and they've been able to prioritize certain projects. It's also built in a sort of interesting governance mechanism where a traditional mechanism has been formalized through an election process. And many of the ones that I spoke to said, even if we lose the development money to implement projects, we will continue to hold elections, because at least we can solve the judicial and the governance problem. We can serve these other roles as well as these elected jurors. And I think that's the importance of the local government being done by the elders, the shura members. But I think in Afghanistan there's place for both. Just like there's place for both a formal judicial and an informal judicial. I mean, it allows people to some extent vote with their feet as to which institution is going to meet their needs best on any given topic. And so, you know, whereas for certain cases they might go to the informal sector, others they will take to the formal sector. And I think that kind of competition just increases the incentives for both the formal institutions and the informal institutions to provide better services for Afghan people. Again, we haven't looked at the translation, so I'm not going to say I know how Afghans feel, but that was my general sense.
You know, just to back that up, I haven't been there for well over a year, but one of the questions I did ask on one tour of the countryside one day was, you're here at the end of the line. Your road is absolutely miserable. To come up here the last 3 kilometers took us half an hour. To get here from Kabul took us about the same amount of time, and it was 10 times the distance. What do you think about it? And they basically, again, the simplest people on earth said, well, you know, if we didn't have that other road, there would be no point in our having a road at all. So they did understand. I mean, they intuitively understood the logic of having something that was of greater value. So I think there is that rather practical point that people come to. And I think that the point that Seema makes about being rather opportunistic, this is an opportunistic moment. Everything needs to be done, and everything is nearly impossible to do. The job is much bigger than even the world's greatest superpower and all of its friends can possibly address. So I guess we better use some of the things that are in place that are serviceable. I have a preference on the justice issue, because I've seen so many international approaches where we let somebody throw tens of thousands of people in jail, and then we ask them to have trials that are up to international standards. And this is really a moment in these countries' history where if we can just get a straight shooting sheriff and a circuit riding judge, we will improve the situation by about 400 or 500%. Okay, not so bad. And we're going to have to give up on some of the other things for the moment. Not that we're not heading in the right direction, but we're just trying to get somewhere. And we thought, a year ago, we thought that it was going to take 10 years to get somewhere in Afghanistan, not because 10 years was a number that we knew, but because 10 years is a long time, and it shows that that we're really looking at the horizon rather than. But every single day, you've got to give people progress of some form in these places, and that's the key element here. You've got to give them something tangible that they can see, even if it's relatively insignificant. And somehow, in some of our bigger plans, we've missed that. I see one of my friends from USAID, and I had the USAID Afghanistan calendar where I get dressed every morning, so every day I'd get to see the picture and the storyline. And I had visited, there was a wonderful new women's center on one, I think it was like October last year, and it was Mr. October, that page of the calendar, it said, when this women's center gets working, 350,000 women will be served in this region. And I'd been out there to visit it, and by the time I got there, they built a wall around the outside of it. And I met, I'd say, 7 or 8 of the most impressive local organizers you could ever see, all women. And none of them were getting paid. And half of them were saying, well, we may have to go back to Pakistan to teach where we got paid. And it was just a really simple thing. We'd created a spectacular facility. We'd gotten the right people in on the job, and nobody was willing to give them $100 a month. And this is already a government that basically we're supporting 90% of their budget. So But there was here we were in a headset that said we don't pay salaries, even though we're paying the salaries of the Afghan National Army. We don't pay anybody else's salaries. Is everybody else less important than the Army? Well, no. The reason the Army is actually showing up for work and doing its job is that they get paid. So, and those people who do get paid, like the police, get 1/7 of what the their counterparts in the Army were getting. So we've made these choices, and there's this the asymmetry of our assistance is one of the issues that I'm sure we'll take on again in our recommendations, but we haven't asked SEMA to do that yet because she hasn't had to write the whole report of the 2 weeks she's been back. Anyway, let's get a couple more questions here. Yes.
My name is Valentina Morano, and I'm from the George Washington University. I know you touched already on this before, but I was wondering if you could talk more about the methodology you used throughout your survey, basic things in terms of, how were the interviews conducted? Were they conducted in English or Dari or Pashto? And then you talked about the fact that you trained those who actually, it's very interesting from a research perspective to know how you carried out that. And, did you use structured interviews or this type of things? And also, if you could, maybe it's too early, but I guess you have an idea of who you're going to make the recommendations to with your final report. And I was wondering if you could, highlight, the main groups. I don't know, the top two or top three groups that you'd like them to listen to.
Should I just tackle them one at a time now? As for the methodology, this is something that, as this is a follow-up study to the baseline that we did last year, we had to employ many of the same, we had to follow the same methodological pattern in order to track it and have trend lines without diverging and comparing apples and oranges. For the Afghan interviews, the six interviewers, they did qualitative interviews. We wrote up an interview guide, which had a number of different open-ended questions that can be asked in any given situation. We also shared this with a number of different people that provided us feedback. Actually, one of them sitting right here, Mr. Javid. They were Afghans and internationals to provide feedback on the text of these questions, the way they sound, the way they translate. We got them translated, and the Afghan interviewers went out speaking to people. They had to speak to people in a very informal manner. It is becoming more and more difficult for researchers in Afghanistan, not only because there is a growing unwillingness to talk to people and answer these questions. They've done it over and over again, and they're, why should we talk to you? I mean, one of our Afghan interviewers said of every 10, one person agreed to do the interview, and that is extremely telling, and it also makes it very difficult to be, very rigid about the way we go about implementing the project. So we did sort of quota sampling. We said we wanted this number, a certain percentage of men and women, ethnic breakdowns that mirror the demographics of society, regional breakdowns that mirror that, and then we sent them out to go and find them. We didn't put brakes on randomized sampling. We didn't think it was important for us. We're not trying to make a statistical statement. What we're trying to do is get the meat and the voice of the Afghans through the qualitative text. We also had them analyze what they had heard and rate rate basically the answer to two questions on a scale of 1 to 10, whether Afghans had felt impact in their lives in the five pillars that we look at: security, justice, governance, economic, and social well-being. And then we ask them whether they see or perceive that long-term capacity building is increasing to meet those needs in the long term. And that's the way we analytically structure our evaluation tool. If you guys have read the old measure of progress, providing decision makers with, on two axes, are short-term needs being met? Are we building the capacity that we need to? And so we had our Afghans rate them also. That's all getting analyzed today. My own methodology was a bit of a snowball sampling. I walked into Afghanistan with names and numbers and emails of people in different organizations, that I wanted to speak to. And, you know, I was trying to mix it up, some poppy farmers, some women teachers, PRT members, military officials. I was trying to get, you know, a cross-section of the type of people that are there implementing and the people that are benefiting from the implementation of projects. And so I went out there and some of them canceled. New ones, I mean, within days, I had lists and lists of new people, and I had to, you know, cut them out and break them down and say, I can't meet with everyone. Who am I going to pick? So it was a seamless process of who I spoke to. In mine also, I was asking them about the sectors that they were working on mostly. I wasn't trying to get a general sense from the implementers how they felt. But with the Afghans, with the focus groups, I asked them about each of the sectors. I followed the same pattern that my Afghan interviewers were following. And used the same tool, the same guided questionnaire to do it, and I rated them the same, you know, as we did in training and things like that. So that's just to give you a bit of a sense of how I went about the process.
Let me just add to that. I mean, we've tried to develop a model that we've called structured conversations, which can be iterative, and you can build on prior conversations and things that you've heard. And so it has an element of journalism to it as well as an element of social science, but we get a kind of a weight of the evidence is the feeling that if you talk to enough people and you let them evolve the discussion as opposed to your saying, how do you feel safe today? So I think that's part of it. We also don't want to put too much weight on any part of this. So we do weight it, and these interviews, the 1,000 interviews or the 999 interviews that we did, basically will make up 20% of our data that we then use, and then just to quickly say the influence we'd like what we'll try to do is we've in the course of these projects we build up a list of several hundred, probably in this case, I don't know what number are we up to in Afghanistan. Our list for Afghanistan, maybe 500 people that we have talked to that are involved with the policy making. We try to communicate with those people. We do as many briefings as we can. We get invited into sort of the Afghan policy groups within the government. We try to sit down with the people and give them our impressions as well. Those, in the case of Afghanistan, they've been really much, much more open and more received than, for example, our work in Iraq, which we've had a real hard time finding some of the decision makers on that. So there has been a more open process. But we recognize that anyone, and lots of congressional interest, people who are running the projects. So we'll just typically, SEMA will probably spend a couple of months just going around and meeting with anybody who has an interest. And so we really do put an awful lot of effort into trying to get this information into the marketplace. A ton of press interviews, those sort of go on, those come and go. We've had a recent flurry of interest in Afghanistan, so we're very involved with that. So, again, it's just an effort to try and get a slightly bigger footprint with this information. And then we do the same thing, obviously, in the country. It's very important. We felt we hadn't done that as well the first time because of budget and other reasons.
Yeah, one thing I would say is that, in Afghanistan, if one person receives you well, you can get into so many different decision makers. And, you know, I found a couple of those people that really were able to push me into ministries, push me through different, through the UN. I'm, you know, up to meeting border officials, you know, border police chiefs and things like that. So people that are not even on the radar of the international community. And it is extremely valuable to have the ability to travel like I did. I see so many people that were in and out of that country and just did not have the freedom to even go to another person's office to have a meeting or go to a coffee shop to have a meeting because they had the security constraints and restrictions on them and made it really difficult for them to do research or understand in that environment what's going on the ground. So
we have about five or ten minutes to go, so maybe we could just do a couple. Let's go back to a couple of quick questions, quick answers, and we'll just try to clear the floor of the questions and give you multiple choice answers. True, false.
True, false.
Yes. Why don't we start right here?
Is this on?
Yeah.
My name's Trent Thompson. I've been with the Afghanistan desk at USAID since 2003, and then of that tour, spent 7 months in the Jalalabad PRT. So I'm going to obviously have a bit of a biased question, but I wanted to fully concur and agree that the communication strategy definitely is not there, because USAID has been involved in 1,500 kilometers of road construction, schools and clinics that are not only built but then also are sustained through the ministries of education and ministries of public health. Power programs, capacity building programs, our alternative livelihoods program is not only the long-term economic growth programs but also cash for work short-term projects where farmer or former poppy farmers can receive an alternative licit salary for short term while these long term programs are underway, as well as even giving money to the ARTF to provide for the recurring costs of the government, such as civil servant salaries. So those programs are going on. It's the communications that I do agree is an issue. But one of the question I have though is related, when you mentioned that most donor support is going to the south or into the southern areas versus the east and the north and the other areas. I was wondering is that a perception issue or is that a reality issue? Because what I understood was that most donor support is going to the east, to the northern eastern areas, as opposed to the south. But
it's a perception. I have not calculated the numbers or added them up on the international scale about how much is actually going there. I did hear news that with the PAG process, more money with this policy action group, which is focused on the South, how to deal with the insurgency, how to do reconstruction and development, and it has the strategic communication portion, which I welcome, it will also tie in more money through that, in that process. But it's a perception out there, and it's a widely held perception. The South is getting things we're not, and I don't know if that's true. I don't know if it's the alternative livelihoods. In the East, I imagine that part of that is the alternative livelihoods thing to some extent, because they're watching what the South is getting versus what they're getting, because they stopped for the year, and they're looking to find some make good on the promises. But about the communication strategy, it is needed, and we can do better on it, I think. And part of that is because there is a willingness of donor to talk about the things they're doing. But there is a less willingness to talk about the constraints they face, the timelines they have, what money they have to actually, and what resources they have to get things done. People don't know that the PRTs don't have, some of the PRTs don't have money. And a lot of them that I spoke to in the north don't have the development funds sufficiently to do the type of programming that Afghans are expecting them to do. And that's the information that's, I think, getting lost. People know the programs. They see them happening or hear about them on the radio, but they need to know the details.
I would add that I think we've expected way too much of the central ministries, and to think that the job is done and we can turn it over to the central ministry, it's in a country that it's impossible to do almost anything except for make a cell phone call to some places. That this whole concept of centralization is just doomed to failure, and especially when the president and nobody else can travel out 5 minutes outside their own place. I mean, there's just a lot of very real pragmatic problems that we've kind of fallen into our pattern, which is, okay, now we'll turn it over to the central ministry. The way I'd like to think of it is if you went to the White House and you said, I've got a good idea for the hurricane-affected areas of the United States, and what we're going to do is we're going to build a ministry here in Washington, 50,000 capable bureaucrats who are going to make everything better in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas. You'd be thrown out of the street in a minute, right? what is it? Why would we think that it's easier to do this in Baghdad and in Kabul than it is in Washington D.C., where it would be impossible to do it? So it's these kinds of judgments that we make that I think are really, really handicap us, and that this is part of having to do our business differently. And we keep falling back on our familiar patterns.
Hello. I'm Ben Barber with USAID, and it's my job. I'm a writer to go out and write about the good things that we do, only the good stuff.
Good. We need you.
The question is, we did a magazine 2 years ago, which was then translated into Dari and Pashto, but I don't think it reached that many people in Afghanistan. Now I just come back doing another magazine. How do you suggest, if it was up to you, how would you communicate to the average Afghan people all around the successful projects and, so to give them a taste that, relax, it's coming. Don't be so anxious. And the second question is there a dependency that's emerging among the Afghans where now they want everything done for them and they've lost the ability to think, well, maybe I can take it from here.
Yeah.
Such as filling in potholes or stuff like that.
I think for the strategic, for the way we communicate what we're doing in the country, part of it will take time to build up the trust in Afghans to trust what the donors are telling them, and that we have to accept. That aside, I think the tools for disseminating the information needs to be thought of. Radio is it really? Maybe TV now. Magazines, the literacy rate just does not allow it to have the same type of infiltration that it needs. And, you know, you talk to most Afghans, the way they hear their news is radio or through other people, you know. And so that's what we need to get to, is the radio or to those other people. And who are those other people to some extent is mullahs, our local leaders, our government officials that can get on the local radio stations in the provinces and not just focusing on the national radio stations. Those kind of things, I mean, those are the type of methods we should use to get out the information.
Can I help on this? And let me jump in on this one, because this is something I've spent a lot of time on when I worked at USAID. And we did this in a lot of different places. And it's just the first place that almost any communication starts with is a message. Mm-hmm. And it's unclear that our message is that clear. And certainly the transparency of our operation is not at all clear in terms of where our money has gone and how it's being spent. And so it starts with kind of knowing what you want to tell people, which I think we've been really – I think we've had mixed messages internal to our government, which makes it very difficult to then be clear. But then in terms of being clear, what Seema says is absolutely right. The number one thing that people like, the most credible, believable medium in every one of the markets that I've ever worked in is people actually seeing things. Mm-hmm. Because trust is so low that unless I see it, I'm not sure I believe it. I'll take it on another way. So people, there's nothing wrong with the radio, but I would, for example, in a country like that, how hard would it be to do this? Hire 500 young Afghans and have them basically go out and be communicators or street theater actors or whatever. We did this in Angola, much, much tougher place. And I could, you know, you could see three actors in the middle of a village, in the middle of nowhere in Angola, and they were doing a skit on how to deal with landmines in a field. And suddenly there'd be 300 women around them in a market. And I knew after 7 minutes that there were 300 people at least who knew everything they needed to know about landmine awareness, everything we were going to get through to them in the next rest of their lives probably. So you've got to use what you've got, and what you have there are a lot of people. They're very capable of communicating. They're known in their community, and you get them out there essentially with this kind of – and furthermore, it's a great jobs program, which isn't bad because you have people doing something that's important to the community. So I would look to – you've got to look to what you have and what you can play with. And I think your work, Ben, has been terrific. But it probably – your concern about it hitting the marketplace, I think, is a valid one.
Part of this requires us to step back. What, like I was saying about the donor databases, knowing who's doing what, where, when certain projects will be finished, I think is not just critical for us to understand the mission and improve our understanding of what's happening in the country, but it can be used in communication. If you know when the school is going to open – that the school is going to, you know, a school in a certain district is going to finish, get the governor, get there, get the radio station, get the camera, get people, do an event and cut the ribbon. And that kind of stuff really goes a long way. If people are, you know, that project then is celebrated as opposed to just being sort of finished and everybody leaves and it's a building that nobody knows what to do with. It gets promoted. And those kind of strategies can be quite effective, I think, there.
Yeah, the radio has been effective. Those radio stations that we visited really were quite quite charming and showed real potential. Mm-hmm. But again, I think the notion of a core of traveling salespeople locally based is probably would be a pretty decent one. And I'm always amazed. We had the same recommendation, a similar recommendation for Jerry Bremer in Iraq in the summer of 2003, that get 1,000 cameras, get 2,000 unemployed graduate students. There are plenty of available. And tell them to go out and film everything that's going on here so people can see that the new power line that's been put up was just blown up yesterday. So people can really get this, because they didn't believe anything in Iraq. Now, there's more believability in in Afghanistan, but the people are much farther back. I mean, if you went in and set up a video in the middle of most of the villages in Afghanistan, you would have instantly 500 or 600 people would be like, "What the heck is that?" And that would be all right. That would be a pretty effective communications moment. So I think there are a lot of opportunities, but we always put this last as if this is a luxury. Okay, I guess we have one more question.
Thank you. Javed Zirak, student from Afghanistan with a research focus on state building and reconstruction in Afghanistan. Thanks, Yuma, for the presentation. I look forward to the report. I think at a time when Washington was a heyday of positivity and optimism in regards to Afghanistan, CSIS was willing to put the title of its first report in the balance. And now when things have turned around, you're counting the measures of progress there. So that goes to the steady nature of the field work that you do there. My question comes on the heels of the question asked earlier by the gentleman from Development Associates Alternatives, or rather Development Alternatives Incorporated, and Rick also... Rick also alluded to this. And it's about, in regard to the third concern, or the third bullet point in your presentation, Seema, you said that one of the major concerns is the highly centralized structure of governance in Afghanistan and how there's a concentration of decision-making power in Kabul. And I think comparing to NSP, a comparison between NSP and the work done by government shows, you know, how decentralization and devolution of that mechanism pays. For example, NSP in Kunduz, which I'm more familiar with, and the foot dragging that's done with the highway reconstruction to Bamiyan that you pointed to. And in some ways, this is a question that has been open since the bond process of 2001 and reached a particular climax in the Constitutional Convention, and then it was permanently dropped off the agenda. If I may make a side point, like Iraq, I think... the constituency in Afghanistan that has traditionally held the power is most reactive to the proposition of devolution and decentralization of power. What I'm wondering in your field work, do you detect any difference in the attitudes towards this proposition of decentralization of power in favor of the provinces between the south and the constituencies in the north and center of the country? Thank you.
Devolution of power to the provincial levels, I think, is highly controversial. I mean, because you're dealing with political people that have something to lose in the process and others that have something to gain in the process. So, you know, I think when you go to the provinces, they say we can do it better, that we should have the ability to spend the money, and yet they lack capacity. There's no international advisors in the provincial governor's office writing proposals. You know, that's all happening at the central level. So you end up getting, I think, to some extent, the natural tug and pull from the center than what you hear in the provinces. I think more interestingly is your question about the difference between the north and the south and the center itself, where the power lies. It's a really unfortunate thing. I was an hour from getting on the car and going down to the south to at least to Khost and to Paktia, to places where it was a little bit better, but really not that much better until I was, you know, really sort of given the no from my friends and supporters down there in Afghanistan. So I wasn't able to go down there and speak to them. But, you know, the Southerners have a more traditional view of being able to... they've been managing their own affairs for so long, and you know, they have their own leadership in there. And I think that there is, from some of the Pashtuns that came from the South but were yet living around Kabul, you know, there was a lot of talk of the feeling that the national government, the centralized government, is not represented by Pashtun leadership. There are Pashtuns there, but a lot of them are diaspora and have come back, is something I've heard. They don't actually have constituencies on the ground and in the districts, is something I heard. So although we think that we've created this really nice ethnic balance, I think in the minds of a lot of Pashtuns, the centralized government, the central government officials are not able to make decisions that speak to their local needs as well as the ones that are on the ground there. In the north, I don't think that this is as much of an issue. Partly that's because the ones that have the power in the north have constituencies. I mean, Governor Atta is a governor of a province in which he has power and constituencies and support, and he makes decisions, and he has the ability to get things done in the center because he's been brought into the fold to some extent, and so he can get money down. And so, you know, I think that perceptions aside, I mean, the perceptions are there that there are perceptions there that the central government cannot make the decisions for them. But on the same note, I think institutionally, I mean, for long-term institution building, it benefits us to try and build the power centers and the power capacity outside of the central government. There are mechanisms that we've set up that don't have the ability, that could have a role to play. The provincial council members that I spoke to was one of them. They have no role to play. Yet the people see them, that voted for them, see them as the only one in their provincial center that they've actually had a say in deciding. The governor is picked from the Ministry of Interior. The chief of police is coming from the, I mean, everybody else is coming from the center. And the provincial council is theirs. And we're not using them. And we could be using them in a way that allows us to institutionally, to institutionally make some changes, but also kind of shies away from trying to make those decisions between governor and center, between the provincial power and the central power, by uplifting some of these other institutions that are there that represent the people and that can also devolve power. It doesn't have to be only done through the governor's office. It can be done through the NSP and provincial council members as well. So.
Thank you very much, Seema. I think I know others of you have questions. Please come on up and join me in thanking Seema for this really excellent.